Omaha Public Radio presents a program from Borders Books and Music on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, author of Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, published by Seven Stories Press. In his latest book, actually a work of fiction, Nader puts 17 of the world's billionaires together in one room to address some of the most pressing issues of our time. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 29, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Borders Books and Music, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to talk about his latest book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, is Ralph Nader.
Let's welcome Ralph Nader.
Thank you all for coming. I've met some of you on the way up, as you know. It's nice to have a classmate of mine from law school, John Will. We shared memories of a very good professor we had, Lon Fuller, who talked about shared purposes. And the inspiration for this first work of fiction of mine was numerous. And one of them was something that Warren Buffett said years ago, when he said there aren't many innovative ideas in philanthropy. And another was that I've learned too many lessons from our losses after our victories, especially in recent years. And I guess I had stored them somewhere in my mind. And it made it very easy to write this book, because it's a book that says, why does citizen action have to be so amateurish and underfunded when it's up against trillion-dollar industries and large government that often serves those industries' purpose against the general interest or the public interest? And what would happen? What would happen if 17 billionaires and multimillionaires in their advanced age, in their 70s, 80s, 90s, when they're losing interest in amassing more money and gaining interest in what significance they're going to be considered in terms of their impact on the world and their grandchildren, what would happen? And we don't think that way. Our imaginations are repressed. And you repress your imagination, you repress your expectation. If you have low expectation levels of what government should do, what business should do, guess what? They're ready to oblige you. And the best way to control people throughout history, much more efficient than military force, is simply to control their expectation levels. So they internalize things that should be externalized in terms of why they can't fulfill their life's possibilities and why power is concentrated in the hands of the few against the many. And why is this relation between big business and government blurring badly, worse than Franklin Delano Roosevelt described it when he called it fascism in 1938? He said, when government is controlled by private economic power, that's fascism. In a message he sent to Congress to create the temporary National Economic Commission to investigate concentrated corporate power. So there are a lot of inspirations for the book, but you know, a lot of people have books like this in them. They're called Practical Utopias by the literati, I was informed after I finished, because I insisted on saying this is not a novel. A novel is too restrictive for what I'm trying to convey. A novel has, you know, hero, anti-hero, plot, character development, lots of detours, and you know, if you ever read Moby Dick, how many pages describing the ships, you know? And I didn't want to go that route. I basically wanted to do a modern rendition of a book I read when I was a child, Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward. It came out in 1898, and It posited a utopia in America in the year 2000. I mean, he fell asleep, woke up, year 2000. then he went back to Boston and the grim reality. And that sold 1 million copies in 2 years. And it really inspired the growing populist progressive movement. And I remember reading that Eugene Debs, the great labor leader, who ran for president 5 times, said that he used this to say to people, it doesn't have to be this way. We can become something different. Let's step it up in terms of our imagination. And if we don't get a higher level of imagination, without going into orbit, we're not talking about science fiction here. If we don't have a higher imagination, we don't have a reach. You don't have a reach, you don't have a grasp. And Lou Uchitel, who's the business reporter for the New York Times, finished a book 3 years ago on the plight of workers who lost their job due to companies going abroad, shutting down, something everybody's familiar with, shutting down and going to places that can be accurately described as communist or fascist dictatorships or oligarchies. And I asked him, I've known him for years, and I asked him what was the singular impression he received from interviewing hundreds of these unemployed or displaced workers. He said the most astonishing thing was that they blamed themselves. I mean, you can explain that in a lot of ways. I would explain it. Is that they didn't grow up in their education with a public philosophy that allocates responsibility to the people who have too much power over their lives. Imagine blaming themselves. So here's the way it starts. Warren Buffett, by sheer chance, is sitting in his living room in his modest home in Omaha, and he's watching the Katrina tragedy unfold. And day one, he's seeing these people stream out of New Orleans, terrified of their kids, what belongings they could muster, nobody coming to help them, short on water, food, shelter, medicine. Got pretty hot in the days after Katrina. The sun came out. And then the fourth day, now he couldn't take it anymore. So he got a whole convoy of trucks, filled them with supplies, got public health workers along, and took everything down with him and started helping on the roadways, on the side of the roads. People were encamped and whatever. And the word started spreading among the families, displaced families, that a billionaire from the Midwest had come to help him. So he gets this extended family, and he's helping and public health workers and putting up tents. And the grandmother grabs his hands, looks in his eyes, and cries out, "Only the super rich can help us." And that's why the title of the book is in quotes. Now that haunts him all the way back to Omaha in the car. And by the time he gets back, obviously there were things percolating for years. By the time he gets back, he knows exactly what he's going to do. And it's not going to be philanthropy. It's not going to be charity. It's going to be taming concentrated power in the hands of the corporate bosses and their political allies who have rendered this country stuck in traffic, gridlock in Washington, and speculation and corruption and bailouts, as we now see, in Wall Street. And, of course, he anticipated a lot of this. And so he gets 16 billionaires and multimillionaires that he screens very carefully in terms of their background, their achievements, their temperament, and he gets them to a mountaintop hotel, which he rented in its entirety, the beginning example of what you can start doing when you've got money. And they meet in Maui, in Hawaii, early January 2006. And they meet every month, early January, early February, early March. And then they start planning the strategy. And there's a lot of dialogue, a lot of conversation back and forth, and about 50, 60 pages in the book, one of the 17, who's a leading lawyer in Texas, Joe Jamail, says, why are we agreeing with each other like this? I mean, this is amazing. We're strong-willed people, and here we are, agreeing. And Warren Buffett said, because I chose you. I chose you based on your temperament, your ability to give and take, and your potential for united purpose. And so, how clever he handled them. Some literature person said about this book that this is the greatest superhero he had ever read in the history of American utopian fiction. So, and the reason why that statement was made is because how he guided this whole thing with the Secretariat, very lean, like he likes, in Omaha. And when this thing exploded in terms of national furor and controversy and excitement and rallies and parades, that he got the, they all got out into the center of cities with bands and music and free food and aesthetics. Yoko Ono provided aesthetics, very important in social justice movements. And she developed this beautiful seventh generation eye as a logo, which became recognizable everywhere. But the way he handled them, first he let them go after the first meeting, and they all did their own thing. Like Jamail and William Gates Sr. Had a record of interest in access to justice. And what Jamail did was he put $15 million right away to develop clinics at law schools around the country who would provide legal advice to people to use small claims courts, because small claims courts were for people, and they were taken over by bill collection agencies. And so all of a sudden, all these companies were being sued in small claims court, you know, the credit card companies, and and this created quite a bit of furor. And Ted Turner, his dream was to collect billionaires together, in real life, by the way, because he gave $1 billion to the UN. And so he creates a group called Billionaires Against Bullshit. And, of course, that's a real grabber of a title. But what he did was he multiplied himself, and he started raising more money from his friends. Now, they had a lot of problems to overcome, obviously. And they were amateurs, but they learned fast, and they had money. And they knew how to get mass media, because they could buy ads. And they also had among their crowd Barry Diller, who controls TV and radio stations and decided to buy up a whole special network that would be, say, other than Fox News, and report activity at the grassroots level. These 17 called themselves meliorists, because they didn't want to be viewed as radicals. Meliorists are people who improve things. And so they started out right across the board with a strategy of top-down, bottom-up. They weren't ideologues. They had their ideas, which came from the people. People want a living wage. People want health insurance. People think the law should crack down on the corporate crooks. People want politicians who respond to them, who go to Washington to represent them. So they started a clean elections party with fielding congressional candidates, but primarily against the toughest incumbent entrenched chairs of the House and Senate committee, who had almost never had any opposition. And there's a great scene actually in Southwest Oklahoma as an example of how they built the people power. A lot of conversation, a lot of meetings, and they hired hundreds and hundreds of lecturers, the way the early populists did in the farm country, and they went into every community. And they did not ignore the American Legion, VFW, women's groups, Kiwanis, Elks Club, Lions Club. They didn't ignore anybody. They did not prejudge, these people won't be interested or not. And so they had a very, very powerful backbone for the titanic struggle, the power collision ahead. And they called these groups, by the way, credibility groups. And that was Ross Perot. He had a lot of entry into those groups from his past activities. And so each one of them had a mission that they went out in February and March. They didn't let anybody know that they were coordinated. So because they wanted to test and they wanted to build so that when the counterattack came from the corporate Goliaths, they had to be ready. They were ready with massive counter ads when the corporate Goliaths went after them. And by the way, the corporate CEOs hired a Darth Vader type character called Lobo. I had fun with him. And he was a composite corporate attorney. I'm pretty familiar with composite corporate attorneys, right, over the years. And so I'll give you an example. Saul Price started the big box discount store, Price Club, and then they merged into Costco. Do you have Costco here? Well, Costco pays better wages and better benefits than Walmart, and they still make a lot of money. So Saul Price, in this fiction, decides he's going to take on Walmart. And when they found out in the executive suite that Saul Price was behind the stirrings that they started feeling, they were terrified, because Saul Price knew everything about them. He knew their weaknesses, their vulnerabilities. He knew, you know, he was the founder. As a matter of fact, when Sam's Clubs in real life started being constructed, they revered Saul Price as the founder of this kind of business, retail business, that they sent like a delegation to pay homage to him. And they said, "Mr. Price, we're doing Sam's Clubs. Like, you know, don't be too upset. We're going to be your competitors." He said, but you know, you are the father of the big box discount retail store." And Price looked at him and said, "Yeah, I wish I'd worn a condom." Now, that's exactly what he told me at dinner. I'm not making this up. He is a kind of scoundrel, not a scoundrel. He's a gruff person with a heart of gold. You've met people like that. Anyway, this is quite a battle in great detail. I think people can learn from how he did it and how distributed his confrontations were, and how good the communication pattern was. Peter Lewis, who was my classmate at Princeton, he built a Progressive insurance company. And he's always been interested in loss prevention. As a matter of fact, he was one of the first insurance companies to equip his company fleet with airbags. And his role here is he takes on the insurance companies for not being interested in loss prevention. That their idea of risk management was financial risk management, not pushing for safer workplaces, safer cars, a cleaner environment to prevent disease and injury. So he has this great dramatic testimony before the U.S. Senate, followed by nine or so insurance executives who are sort of quaking in their boots about coming up after him. And he's a man who called the tort law system quality control. So you can see, this is actually what he told me. And he said, "For my business, tort law is quality control." So it goes on and on. And they decide also that they're going to recruit the best talent right down to the community level in terms of 2,000 people will be located in every congressional district with full-time staff to monitor and push Congress in the right direction. Now that is basically 1 million people. And that will cost about $50 million a year to maintain. $50 million a year is nothing when you got that kind of money. The entire campaign in this book priced out at $15 billion. Because I want to try to show, we get out of our mindset of trying to use pennies to take on big bucks in citizen action, it's not going to happen. 1984 was a dystopia, not a utopia, and Brave New World was a dystopia. Well, progressives or people who want to change this country, if they think they can continue doing it by simply documenting the abuses, diagnosing the problems, denouncing the culprits, and proposing solutions, it's not going to happen. Now, I know I've already received some criticism from my progressive friends, like, oh, you mean we're going to rely on the super rich here? I said, look, the abolition movement got a lot of rich people from Boston supporting it against slavery. The civil rights movement got millions of dollars from families like the Stern family in New Orleans and the Curry family in Virginia. So there's precedent for this. You don't want to stereotype all rich people, especially in their advanced age. They want to move, as was said in the book, from success to significance. And as a result, it unleashed these repressed civic and political energies of people all over the country. They found natural leaders which they never heard of. These huge rallies were spoken to by natural speakers who had experienced what's going on in the neighborhoods, in the rural areas, in the farm country, in the cities, and so forth. And this is all really could be real. The cover quote by Tom Peters, who wrote In Search of Excellence, a big bestseller in the 80s, he said that this is a work of fiction I would love to see become nonfiction. Once you accept the predicate of that kind of capability, that kind of catalyst, shoehorn, lift up, give people a hand. The woman who typed this into the computer, because I wrote this on an Underwood typewriter. And see, I can keep working when the lights go out, you know. And people see, the way they look at you now when you say you use a typewriter, you know, a manual typewriter. Like McCain was criticized because he didn't know how to use a computer. What absurdity. It's what's in the mind, right? So it's a tool. You can't use a tool. Can we use all the popular tools? So there is a functional reason why I use a typewriter. Can I digress a minute? I don't like to correct my drafts, and it's very difficult to erase when you use a manual typewriter. So you discipline yourself to do first draft near final draft or just two drafts, where in a computer you can erase and, you know, it evaporates stuff and adjust, and so you get a little sloppy writing. At least I would. At any rate, the woman who typed this in, she owns a little tiny diner. It's actually the smallest diner in America. It's got 14 seats. But she wants to make some money on the side. So she was typing it. She was getting more and more intrigued. And I said to her after it was over, I gave her a copy of the book, and I said, Jean, why did you like this book? She said, because it really made me feel good that rich and powerful people cared for people like me and gave me a role, gave me an opportunity to participate in improving our country. Because we don't really know what to do, but if we get a chance and we can, someone tells us how we can go about doing it, we'll take it. We'll take it. I mean, we're busy making ends meet. These rich people were amateurs too, but they learned fast because they had money and they could get very skilled people. Well, at one time, at the peak in this book, they had 400 recruiters sifting hundreds of thousands of resumes. So you can see the quantitative scope of what they were doing. And what did it amount to? It's less than one-third of Warren Buffett's net worth. And in the middle of the book, and he was keeping track. He was making sure this thing wouldn't go with a flood of red ink. He liked that when I told him that at breakfast this morning. He said, yeah. I said, you had a very lean secretariat. And when this was the biggest news story day after day, what all you people were doing in America, you grudgingly added eight people to the staff. That was the core staff. And but about halfway through, he's flying back from Maui, and he says to his associate, he says, you know, look at all we've done. Look at all we've facilitated. Look at the country waking up to its long overdue potential, not pie in the sky, long overdue improvements. And we've just spent $8 billion. He says, that's a sixth of what I'm worth. That's what happens when you try to shift power from the few to the many. You unleash a lot of volunteer effort. You unleash a lot of good ideas. And interestingly, the minute the press learned that these rich guys were behind a lot of this, they got huge free press, just like Perot. Once they found out he was a multi-billionaire running for president, he got huge free press. You know, we live in a society that says, hey, this guy's got a lot of money, so he's going to be a factor. I speak from experience in reverse. Like they asked me when I run, how much money you got to spend? You know, well, we just have positions supported by a majority of the American people. That's not enough. Okay. So, and I don't want to keep going on, but I do want to give you a flavor of the thing to do. They started a People's Chamber of Commerce for tens of thousands of small and medium business that who didn't want the Chamber of Commerce and National Association of Manufacturers speaking for them in Washington. They had a different view of business. You know, they weren't corporate welfare types. They were the ultimate capitalists, namely, you succeed, or if you don't, you fail. You don't go to Washington for trillions of dollars of bailout, as the Wall Street firms did. The second thing they did, they had to find out what the trade associations were planning to oppose them. So here's what they did. They bought one business in every sector of the economy. They bought a dry cleaning establishment. They bought a fast food restaurant. Bought an insurance agency. They bought a bank. They bought a car dealership. And therefore, they got inside the trade associations. And they decided to put forth best practices, sustainable practices, as a model. But they also got all kinds of intelligence. And they learned that the trade associations, in the critical dynamic month of August, when all the members of Congress were going back to feel the heat from the people, that the heads of all these trade associations were going on vacation. So they deduced that they still didn't get it in terms of this tidal wave of popular ferment that was heading toward Washington. And then they decided that they had to deal with the right-wing talk show hosts. And the two ones that were portrayed in the book are one is named Pawn Vanity and the other is named Bush Bimbo. So how did they deal with them? Because, you know, they were going to be hammered day in and day out, 3 hours a day. Well, they decided to decoy them. So they put proposals with a national ad by one to replace the national anthem of Star-Spangled Banner with America the Beautiful. And two, they got inner school teachers who couldn't get their facilities fixed, leaking roofs, rats, and so forth, broken desks, to say to their children, you will now pledge, the Pledge of Allegiance will no longer be a lie. It will no longer be with liberty and justice for all. It will be with liberty and justice for some. Well, the talk show host took the bait. It was like red meat. And week after week, there is huge denouncing and all their epithets. Meanwhile, the meteorists were building traction all over the country. So it was a decoy strategy that worked. But one of my favorite little scenes, because I've really been fed up with Rush Limbaugh, because he's a total coward. He's a soliloquist. He can't debate anybody, and he screens all his calls. And one time he had a TV show with a live audience. He never allowed the live audience to get one question in his TV show. So I reserved this scene for him where he was losing ratings because he was losing a lot of his listeners to this movement. So to recover his ratings, and I said this, by the way, this morning on Fox Radio, just before Limbaugh came on, So Scott was okay. He said he invited Ted Turner to be interviewed in his studio, and he'd never done that before. So he starts out, he introduces Ted Turner. 4 words into this introduction, insulting him from right and left. And so Ted Turner, being no patsy, fires back. So they go at it like this. He can't take it anymore. He pulls the plug on Turner. So Turner grabs Bimbo's microphone, and Bimbo puts his hand up like this, and Turner goes like this, and Bimbo's swivel chair goes all the way to the corner of this big studio. And so he's got the whole audience by himself for about 45 seconds, and he makes the most of it. And then Bimbo comes back, and you know, his assistants are holding up the signs and so on and so forth. Well, that's not going to happen, obviously. But there is a little literary license that we're allowed. Now, who would like to read this book? Well, I think that people who read this book are going to come out feeling stronger as a citizen. I think they're going to come out being less inhibited, asking rich people to contribute to a more just society. And I think that they will learn a lot of little and big ways to advance their own community betterment, from the kinds of strategies that we use, the kinds of motivations, the use of food, art, music, the use of parades. They resurrected the use of purposeful parades, not simply memorial parades, but forward, purposeful parade. They revolutionized in this book the meaning of Labor Day and got millions of people out. It wasn't just a sale, you know, a 3-day sale. So I'll just end on this note. Leslie Stahl read this of 60 Minutes on her vacation last month, and she wrote me a nice letter saying she thought the book, it's a big book, you know, my answer to Ayn Rand, but I couldn't go to 1,150 pages like she can, with John Galt's speech being 103 pages, one speech. She said it was engrossing, creative, and funny. I said, I'll take all three. And I did this deliberately because, you know, there's a lot of serious things here. There are a lot of people dying and getting sick, and I mean, there's so much misery. We're way behind Western Europe, and right out of World War II, devastated, they decided that a productive economy was going to solve economic problems as a community. They essentially abolished poverty as we know it, and they got universal health care and decent public transit, tuition-free university, paid maternity leave and paid family sick leave and paid as a community, and paid child care, decent wages by comparison with our lower third, and decent pensions, and paid 4-week vacation. Sure, you know, the collective paid for it. Look what they got for it. And 64 years later, we have none of these for all the people in our country, and we're the richest country in the world. I mean, it makes you think, why didn't we get it? Why did they get it? Could it be a multi-party system? Could it be stronger trade unions? Could it be their cooperatives, which are much stronger than our cooperatives? Could it be they started from devastation? It's interesting. You start from devastation, you might think differently. You don't have so much obstacles to overcome. Obviously, the corporations in 1946 in Europe weren't in a position to crush these kinds of movements. And so this is all about liberating our imaginations. And it does something to us when that occurs. Now, I obviously didn't tell the people I was doing this, the 17. You just don't do that. Nobody told me that I was being used in fictional renditions and sometimes very unpleasant ones, so it's happened to me. But I did give them a heads up and gave them the book early, and I suppose they're in the process of reading it, and they don't want to make any public statements till they read everything that I put in their mouth. But one of them was snippy when I called him. And I want to try to deal with it before I reveal the name. And I finally said, look, you know, you're coming out as a hero. He says, I don't care, he said. I said, well, why don't you read it and let me know? So that's where it stands right now. And I hope our website is onlythesuperrich.org. It's designed to get people's comments and to extend it. This is a book I hope has legs in terms of how people react to it in small ways, medium ways, and big ways. So thank you very much. Anybody want to start? I've had great difficulty getting on Bill Moyers, Terry Gross, Diane Rehm, and Charlie Rose. As far as I remember, that's all public radio and public TV. And a lot of right-wing people get on those shows. There's a kind of fear in public radio and public TV of the anti-public radio and TV people in Congress who always want to cut their budgets. And also they're relying more and more on corporate donations. So I think if any of you want to see this book discussed on those programs, it's pretty easy to email them, email their offices, and if they get a feedback, maybe I'll get a call. But it's a pretty bad state of affairs when you get on commercial media with a higher frequency than you get on these public radio and public TV. As a matter of fact, once I called Terry Gross, and by mistake she picked up the phone, and oh, Terry Gross. I said, well, you know, I'm running third, however distant, in the presidential race, and got a lot of things to talk about that people seem to be supportive of. And she said, oh, I said, why can't I get on? She said, oh, well, you know, I have a lot of people who want to get on my show. There's an old Latin phrase, res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. So if you give us a hand, it would be good.
Okay. What you described, I don't seem to see. I don't read about it. I don't. Where are these corporate people having these meetings that you hear? You would think that this would get in the news, but I don't seem to find it or hear about it.
You mean in the book?
Well, that you talked about, all these rich people getting together and supposedly starting things. And
oh, well.
I don't hear about this.
Well, I didn't hear either, which is why I fictionalized it. Okay. You're right. They are redefining philanthropy a bit, the Gates Foundation and infectious diseases. And it's beginning to mature. But Warren Buffett said years ago there hadn't been many innovative ideas in philanthropy. And that's true because there's a difference between fostering charity and fostering justice. I mean, a society that has more justice needs less charity. And justice goes to the source, say, of hunger in America, and charity goes to soup kitchens. And both are important.
Back during the Kennedy administration, Nikita Khrushchev made a statement that they would never have to fight us, that we would destroy ourselves. If I'm not mistaken, this week in New York City, they're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the establishment of communism in China. Do you see our circumstances socially and economically as a culmination or a part of the spin that's been going on for the last 60 years?
Well, if I understand your question right, I'll preface it by saying never in my wildest nightmares did I think that corporations would use our government and empty out whole factories and unemploy whole millions of workers and ship them to fascist and communist dictators overseas. I mean, that to me is beyond the pale. And the fact that they got away with it, given the anti-communist fascist ideologies and, you know, we grow up saying these are bad ways of governing, is a stunning example of how powerful they are. In China, they're paying 50, 60 cents an hour. That is not a living wage. They're shipping back into this country contaminated food, materials for pharmaceuticals that have killed Americans, one drug, 210 dead, because the companies are trying to make a few bucks more profit per unit, and they didn't examine the laboratories in China. And China, you know, its biggest problem by their own admission is pollution. It's everywhere. Air, water, food, you name it, fish, aquaculture. And the stuff is coming back into this country. Just think of that. Losing jobs, closing down industries, hollowing out communities, going overseas to a very exploitive economy where independent trade unions formation is a crime and you go to jail. And then they ship it back to us. What are we doing in this country? I mean, where's the breaking point? Please tell me, what's the breaking point? What is the breaking point? We got two parties who are going along with this. And they're shutting out third-party and independent candidates. All kinds of ballot access obstacles. And much harder to get on a ballot now running for president as an independent or third party than in the 19th century. What is the breaking point? Does anybody know what the breaking point is? I mean, if you see that movie Network, what did it say? I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. What is the breaking point? Yes.
My question is, were you familiar with the Borgen Project before you started writing this book, or are you now familiar with it?
No.
A young man, maybe 6 or 8 years ago, I was surfing around the internet, and I found him, and he had quantified what it would cost to rid the world of poverty and to provide health care for 6 billion people, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the costs are small.
I mean, he took it from the only calculation that's been done substantively is the UN Development Program.
And indeed, that's a lot of the basis of his information.
About 50 billion a year.
Yeah.
For minimal nutrition and health, you know, basic health care.
Right.
For a billion and a half people.
So
it's not expensive.
Yes.
I mean, it's not expensive to feed starving kids, for example.
To use an awful word that we've coined in America, it is doable.
Yeah.
It is possible.
Cost beneficial.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, do you actually know Barry Diller?
Yes.
Because why hasn't that happened already? That was like the number one thing that needed to happen on September 12th, is that progressive media needed to take the forefront, or at least a stand. And it wasn't done and still hasn't been done, except piecemeal.
The mass media panicked, and the public media panicked after 9/11.
And they're still hiding in
the
holes.
They're afraid of being accused of, you know, lack of patriotism. And you know, it was basically, the White House basically said to the American people, shut up and shop. We'll take care of the rest.
Right.
And, you know, don't stop buying for the economy. Barry Diller's interesting. The reason why I selected him, among others, is not just that he controls a lot of TV and radio media.
Right.
So he wrote an article once for the New York Times saying that the public airways belong to the public. They're owned by the public, and there's a public trust that's involved. So one of the initiatives in this book is that they got hundreds of people around a number of TV stations. Many of them are in short buildings. You've seen TV stations. I mean, they're not. They have antenna, but, you know, they may be three-story. So they, just before the late evening news, they surrounded them all with hundreds of people with signs, pay rent. Pay us rent. We own the public airways. You are using them for profit 24 hours a day. You don't pay the Federal Communications Commission anything since 1934 Radio Act, or 1927 Radio Act. And you're using our property free and deciding who says what and who doesn't, and you're not paying us any rent. So it was pay rent, pay rent. So they did it to test whether the evening news would report it, because it's right outside their building, and it's hundreds of people. And most of them didn't report it. They put out a terse statement saying, there are some people who are raising internal administrative issues of our business, which we don't think are of any interest to the audience. But How many things do we own in this country as a commonwealth that we have no control over? One-third of America, the public lands, the public airwaves, trillions of dollars of government research and development, like discovering and testing pharmaceuticals, which are then given under CRADA agreements to monopoly marketing agreements to the big drug companies like Taxol, to the anti-cancer drug, to Bristol-Myers, with no price control or no royalties back to the government to plow back for more research. So a lot of things that corporations take credit for, the taxpayer paid for. The taxpayer paid to discover, taxpayer paid to test, the taxpayer paid to transfer the technology, the taxpayer paid to bail them out. And so I once wrote in real life, I wrote a letter to the top CEOs of America, and I said, isn't it about time that you had a taxpayer appreciation day? And why not April 15th, where you say to the American taxpayer, who has sustained you, bailed you out, subsidized you, thank you. They were not amused. Yes.
Why did we bail out everybody in Washington and use all that money? Hasn't it done any good?
One, because we deregulated them in 1999 and abolished Franklin Delano Roosevelt's reforms like Glass-Steagall, which prevented companies from owning a commercial bank and an investment bank at the same time. So they went wild with speculation, high-risk derivatives, subprime mortgages, collateralized debt obligations, and all over the mumbo-jumbo, which were essentially bets on bets on bets. And then he sold them to places as all over the world as securitized. And they got Moody's and Standard & Poor's to say, oh, these are really AA, AAA, when they weren't, they were extremely fragile and collapsed the system. Now, when that happened, Wall Street had Washington by the neck, saying the whole economy can go down if the financial industry goes down. But in reality, as far as reform goes, Washington had Wall Street over a barrel, because in return for bailing them out, Washington could have gotten anything they wanted through in terms of structured reform. And they didn't do it. Instead, Wall Street rolled Washington into the barrel and got what they wanted. And so here we are, over a year later, since Lehman Brothers failed, and there's not one single reform bill, even through one committee of Congress. This has never happened in American history. The paralysis of Congress, even with the Democrats controlling it, and 60 senators and so on in the House, is unprecedented in American history. Usually when there's that kind of crisis, they act. Even without an immediate crisis, just the regular 45,000 people dying every year from motor vehicle crashes, we got the auto companies regulated under Lyndon Johnson. The first hearing was March 66. He signed the bill September 66. It saved over a million lives and prevented millions of injuries. So we're dealing here with a very serious societal paralysis by gridlock ruling people who have got us right where they want us. They really have us right where they want us. They've got single-party districts, all Republican or all Democrat, gerrymandered to suit whoever runs the state government, and most of them don't have to worry about re-election. We were taught in high school that when that occurred, they'd be more courageous, right? They wouldn't have to worry about re-election. It'd be more courageous. It'd be more secure. It's just the opposite. They're so secure, they don't want to rock any boat.
What about term limits?
I'm for term limits. 12 years are out. First of all, I've only seen one or two members of Congress in the last 30 years who either didn't wear out or sell out after 12 years. I mean, they either wear out and they just sort of go with the flow, or they sell out. 12 years is enough. 6 years is too short, but 12 years is enough. They say, oh, what about all that experience? Yeah, look at all that wonderful experience. What's it bought us, all this experience? I love the way they say, you got to go with the experience. What experience? Experience in doing the people in? I don't know why they don't seem to have a sense of history, how they're viewed. They're so short-sighted, you know, and get the campaign money in and have the fundraising parties and, you know, make sure you don't have a primary opponent. Just they don't have a sense of history. And after a while, those are the people who run, and the good people don't run. It's so horrible what they have to do to run. And they grovel around, and, you know, they go to these parties where you have the auto dealer pack or you have the, what do you call it, the insurance pack or the bank pack, and they basically have to pledge allegiance to the particular issue before they get to check. It's so demeaning. These parties are going on all the time in Washington. Yes.
So do you think they're ever going to, like, audit the Federal Reserve?
Well, Wright Patman wanted it years ago, a congressman from Texas, and it's being vigorously opposed by the Wall Street types, the Federal Reserve, and Obama has not come out for it. And he's reappointed Bernanke. So the answer to your question, for the foreseeable future, no. Did you know that the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank, but in most other countries, it's a cabinet-level ministry accountable to the parliament. But we have a central bank. Do you know where its budget comes from? Bank fees. The banks not only control the Federal Reserve, they fund it. None of your tax dollars are appropriated for the Federal Reserve, so it's not accountable. So there are people in Congress who say, let's audit the Federal Reserve. Just audit it to see, what are you guys doing behind those closed doors? How can you bail out a giant bank in a weekend and, in effect, print all that money and obligate taxpayers? And it's not going to happen. And one man can make it happen. His name is Barack Obama, and he's not up to it. He's conflict-averse, doesn't like to take on power. Harmony ideology type. You've met him. You've met people like that, haven't you? They can't stand conflict. Well, when you're in a position of power and millions of people are thinking you're going to act because they voted for you, and they know that you have to have change and hope, remember that one? And you're conflict averse, that's a rather serious personality trait. Yes, ma'am.
Obviously, with my wonderful walker here, I do have health issues, and I am uninsured. I was wondering, what do you think of the actual likelihood that we will actually get some sort of real health care reform?
Well, it's diminishing. The comprehensive nature is diminishing by the week. You can read about it. Because Obama didn't take a strong, explicit proposal to Congress and hold it, his party is split. Blue Dogs. That means he's lost a functioning majority if the Blue Dogs split off. So something will get through because the drug companies, health insurance companies want to get over it, and they've pretty much pleased with what they're going to get, more customers and not that many restrictions on them. There'll be more subsidies to cover people like you if you qualify A, B, C, footnote A. The Canadian Health Care Act, which passed about 3 decades ago and covered everybody. And by the way, they cover everybody with 10% of their GDP. We're at 16.5% and 50 million people are not covered and tens of millions underinsured. And so you know how big the bill was? You know how long? This bill that's coming out is going to be at least 1,400 pages, which means it's unworkable. I can tell you from, you know, those of us who go to law school, anything that complex is usually ambiguous. It's full of waivers. It's very hard to implement, very expensive to implement. The Canadian Health Care Act, the basic charter that created the full Medicare for all in Canada, 13 pages. And so what are you going to get? I don't know, because they have so many, well, what's your income? What's your situation? The thing that's going to blow this bill apart in practice is the mandate. They're going to force people, especially if the public option fails, they're going to force people to buy insurance from the very companies that have abused consumers all these years, the very companies like Aetna and Cigna, who have a perverse incentive in making more profit by denying benefits and avoiding the sick. And this is not like normal business incentive. It's a perverse incentive, which is why all Western countries have gotten rid of for-profit health insurers. They have nonprofit delivery. And the single-payer system, which is supported by a majority of doctors, nurses, and the American people, is just government insurance and private delivery, free choice. But it's still private delivery. And what are the talk show hosts, the Yahoos, doing? They're telling people who then call C-SPAN and so on, the government is taking over health care. The issue that's being debated is health insurance, not health care. This is not a system where the doctors and the hospitals work for the government. Well, one other thing, there's an article in the Journal of Public Health 3 weeks ago by two Harvard Medical School professors, and they did very careful data from the CDC. 45,000 people, they estimate, lose their lives every year in America because they can't afford health insurance to get treatment. Now, just let that sink in for a moment. That's 800 a week. That's as many people who die on the highways. And nobody in Canada, Luxembourg, Germany, France, England, Italy die because they can't afford health insurance, because they're insured from the moment they're born. Now, when I hear figures like that, I turn red with shame. I'm collectively ashamed that the people of this country have not said enough is enough, and we're going to break our routines, and we're going to lock arms, and we are going to design the system by which we want to live. And if 45,000 die, how many hundreds of thousands are injured or sick and can't get treatment? We know these people. We hear about it all the time. People in their 20s, for example, come out of their family coverage and they're on their own and their jobs are being outsourced. They don't know where to get insurance, or they have to beg and scratch for it. So this is, you know, Freud appealed to our sense of guilt. Jung appealed to our sense of shame. Shame is a much more powerful motivator. That's what we really got to focus on. When you know, I was raised by my mother and father and my three siblings, and I wrote a book on how we were raised, and it's probably in a bookstore now here, called 17 Traditions. And they never said freedom, freedom, freedom without responsibility. Civic responsibility. My father said to me once, if you don't use your freedoms, you're going to lose your freedom. My mother once, when I was 8, said, Ralph, do you love your country? They love to use Socratic method question. Ralph, do you love your country? Yeah, of course, Mom. Well, I hope when you grow up, you work hard to make it more lovable. See? Duty. No flag waving. Duty. Responsibility. Gratification. Justice. What Senator Daniel Webster called the great work of human beings on earth. Justice. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very, very much.
You've been listening to a program from Borders Books and Music on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader, author of Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, published by Seven Stories Press. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 29, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Ashley Roberts of Seven Stories Press for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.